Okay. Wait a minute, how do I get this digital thing? Don't want that. Where is it? It's disappeared. It's the usual thing with the screens here. I have to wait, let me disconnect. Hold on a sec. Sorry about that. All right, very good. Okay, so I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to this very nice meeting. I'm having a very good time. It's my first time at Kavli. It's very, very pleasant, and I'm learning a lot. So the topic of my talk is H1 to H2 transitions in galaxy star-forming regions. It's going to be a theory talk, and I'm going to try to give an overview of the topic and also some recent analytic results. Okay, so here's my cartoon version. We've seen various cartoons. This is my cartoon version of the galactic ISM. It's multi-phased, as we know. It consists of various components, the hot ionized medium, warm neutral medium, where the gas becomes neutral. Embedded inside the warm neutral medium, we have the cold neutral medium clouds, and eventually also molecular gas. So the interstellar medium is exposed to starlight, shockwaves, energetic particles, magnetic fields. Global ISM is heated and energized by stars, outflows, radiation, and supernova explosions. So it's very dynamic, turbulent, and dusty. Total galactic ISM mass is around 5 × 10⁻⁹ solar masses. The midpoint thermal pressure at the solar circle is around 2.5 × 10³ in these units, and that enables multiphase behavior, as we've heard a few times. Most of the mass is in the cold neutral phase, and most of the volume is in the hot ionized phase. And there's this conversion from H1 to H2, and that's associated with star formation, and there's debate as to whether this is a necessary condition or is associated as a correlate with the collapse of clouds. That's not the topic of this talk, but it's an interesting question. I think it's an open question, in my view. So here's the outline of my talk. I'm going to give a very brief history and motivate the topic more clearly. Then I'm going to talk about the H1 to H2 theory for the H1 to H2 transition. I'm going to talk about some radiative transfer computations of this process. And then I'm going to show my analytic formula for the H1 column density, which is of great use and for interpreting observations, also for incorporation into hydrosims. I'll apply it to a discussion of self-regulated media. And then I'm going to apply the theory and test the theory to some degree with interpretation of observations of the Perseus molecular cloud, and I'll also say something about galaxies.
I mean, I think if you turn the light.
Oh, you don't hear me?
Very correctly.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just
sorry. So
that's not good.
No, I'll do it. I have the same. Let's see. All right, is that better? Thank you. That's my very good. Thank you. Okay, so this work is described in these three recent papers. Much of what I'm going to say is based on this paper, but I'm also going to be describing results from these two additional papers, all linked. I do want to mention this paper over here, which we've recently posted, which is in the same. The theory is in the same spirit of what we did in here, except it's applied to the C+. H2 component, which is of great interest. Okay, some brief history. To my knowledge, the first discussion of molecular hydrogen formation in the interstellar medium in the astrophysics literature is in this paper from 1948, Lyman Spitzer. Here's the from the abstract, this is from the text somewhere. Molecular hydrogen may possibly be more abundant in H1 regions than the observed CH and CN that they knew about back then. So Spitzer was starting to think about this. The first a major step was this paper, Molecular Hydrogen H1 Regions, where Hollenbach, Werner, and Salpeter actually started thinking about actual computations of conversion on dust grains versus photodissociation in equilibrium conditions. So they were still thinking in terms of the formation of H2 within the diffuse medium, but this is was a seminal paper. I love this one. Okay, there's the abstract, that's the entire abstract. So I will show this to students. We have found intense 2.6 millimeter line radiation from 9 galactic sources with reattributed carbon monoxide. Okay, so they got the Nobel Prize for something else, but I think they deserved it for this as well. And of course, we all know that CO is the proxy tracer for H2, and H2 is difficult to observe directly, although it can be observed in some conditions. Conversion to H2 is critical for molecule formation in general, and a major paper was by John Black and Alex Delgano, the H1 to H2 conversion initiating chemistry and formation of all of the metal-bearing molecules in the gas phase. Two additional papers from many years ago, this one that I wrote many years ago, and this paper on the structure of photodissociation regions, where next steps were taken in dealing with the line transfer. On jumping forward to more recent times, there's this paper by McKee and Krumholz, Chris and Mark, which is the third in the series of the three papers on this topic, where the focus was thinking about H1 to H2, but more on global scales, galactic-wide scales, not necessarily focused on individual clouds in the galaxy, as had been done in the earlier work. And then there's this paper, which we published a couple of years ago, which we tried to sort of synthesize everything. I do want to say as a remark that these papers invoke spherical symmetry in the models. Turns out that that's nice, but unnecessary. And actually, it's overly complicated. And I'll try to explain that. Further observational motivation on galaxy scales, if we look at objects in the nearby universe, we can actually associate the H1 with photodissociated layers of the H2. And here there was the conceptual change occurred in the 1980s when there was this change from thinking more in terms of molecule formation in the diffuse medium, so H2 forming in the H1, as opposed to H1 forming out of the H2 via photodissociation. So this is an example of that kind of work. And of course, now we've moved on to high redshift, and I'm part of this team. It's nice to see this, the spatially resolved molecular clouds at high redshift. And I mentioned that. Okay, so here's this 8-year-old plot, which I think is still very nice to look at. And of course, the association of star formation with gas is known, the Schmidt-Kennicott relationship. But what's interesting is that when one follows, that if one plots surface star formation rate versus total gas density, that there is this point where it appears as though there's a sharp drop in the star formation rate associated with conversion from predominantly H2 gas to H1 gas. And there's a threshold at around 10 solar masses per square parsec. I want to mention this nice poster out there that you should also look at. So here's the one form of the Schmidt-Kennicott relationship. Star formation rate per unit area, and these various parameters that come in. So there's the surface density, there's the dynamical time, there's the efficiency per dynamical time, and the fraction of H2. So what I'm talking about, the relevance of what I'm talking about is for computations of FH2, ultimately. Okay, so that's the background. I'm going to start doing some theory now. So I'm going to be juggling a large number of parameters. So I want you to keep your eye on them. Before I start this, I want to make I want to quote a famous philosopher, which I really like this one. Okay, so I'm going to read this. This is Ludwig Wittgenstein from Philosophical Investigations. I don't advise reading that in one shot. Okay, that's something that's not advisable. A perspicuous representation produces just that understanding which consists of seeing connections. Hence the importance of finding and inventing intermediate cases. The concept of a perspicuous representation is of fundamental significance for us. It earmarks the form of account we give the way we look at things. I think that's a beautiful description of analytic theoretical astrophysics. Okay, and so I have nothing against simulations. I think simulations are wonderful, but this is, he's talking about analytic theory here. So that's what I'm going to do. Okay, so H1 to H2 transition. Here's an idealized system, one-dimensional, visual magnitude, parameterizing depth, and radiation field coming in. This is the photodissociating radiation field. So this is your simple PDR. And there are various parameters that come in. I'm going to be talking about them. One is something I call the effective Lyman-Wunderband photon flux. So it's not exactly the flux of radiation coming in. It's actually the amount of flux that, in principle, could be absorbed by molecular hydrogen after subtracting off the amount that's absorbed by dust associated with the H2. So that's what I call the effective Lyman-Wunderband photon flux. I'm going to assume a fixed gas density, a grain surface formation rate coefficient. There's also attenuation by dust absorption, so I have to talk about a dust absorption cross-section, and metallicity enters as an associated parameter affecting, conceivably, both R and sigma G. Photodissociation by H2 is a very well-characterized process. Here it is. Here's the description of it. It's actually an unusual photodissociation process for molecules, and it's in two steps. So here's the ground electronic state, and here are two of the electronic states which are accessible by photons less energetic than ionizing radiation. And it's a two-step process. One absorbs a photon this way. Most go down to the ground state again, but some go into the continuum leading to dissociation. That's called spontaneous radiative dissociation. I should say that cosmologists call that feedback, but the formal rule is spontaneous radiative dissociation. This fraction is 0.12 on average. And in that 2014 paper, we calculated for a drain interstellar field, we calculated the free space H2 dissociation rate to 1% accuracy. So it's the most accurate calculation of it to date. And the literature is 5.8 times 10 to the minus 11 per second. That's a fundamental parameter. The radiation, because this photodissociation is occurring in lines, and these lines have large oscillator strengths, they get optically thick very quickly. That's called self-shielding. And here is a calculation that we carried out with the Moudon PDR code, which has good radiative transfer, including the effect of overlap of absorption lines together with the dust absorption and scattering. And here's a typical, at a very small depth into the system, this is what the radiation field looks like. You see all the absorption lines are about 80 typically strong absorption lines.
What are the cone
lengths in this case? I don't remember what, it's very small. This is just a very, very small, it's probably 10 to the 15 or 10 to the 16. So very, very small, but the point is that the self-shielding sets in at a column density which is very, very small compared to the column density you need for dust absorption. So that sets in very quickly. In fact, there are two effects. One is the H2 absorption lines that start getting optically thick, but you're always absorbing out in the wings more and more. And then there's the dust absorption, which ultimately sets in, and here's the dust absorption cross-section, which I write, I'm assuming here is varying linearly with the metallicity, although this is not an essential assumption for the theory that I'm doing. I can put in any dependence there. Oh, there's a different, each Lyman-Wunderband is divided into different rotational states, so there's a fine structure. So these are different, these transitions are between different vibrational levels, and each transition has also rotational structure. Okay, so I was referring to something I call the effective dissociation flux. So a big sort of trick in the analytic theory that we developed in this paper was to actually define this thing. You can imagine the following question. Imagine you have a cloud which you force to be fully molecular, so there's no dissociation, or you force it to be molecular or there's very little atomic hydrogen that's formed. You can imagine that, taking the density to be infinite so that you have a very, 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 very high formation rate. Nevertheless, you can ask how much of the radiation coming in is going to actually be absorbed by the H2 as opposed to the dust. And that's going to depend on the dust cross-section because they're competing. So what we define here is as a function of the dust cross-section or as a function of the metallicity, effectively, what is the effective equivalent width of radiation that goes that is available to dissociate the H2. So at low metallicity, there's no dust. Essentially, all of it goes into H2. At higher metallicity, the decreasing fraction goes into H2. And again, I'm assuming here this is something which can be computed in advance once. It's universal. This is just a function which one can then use later on. But it defines this little W here. So the effective dissociation flux is the flux of radiation coming in times the diffraction that go into dissociation times this little W, which is this curve, which is telling you how much of the radiation can actually be absorbed by H2 as opposed to the dust associated with just the H2.
But that's for a static slab.
What?
For a static slab.
Yes, for a static slab.
There's no internal
motions. No internal motions, correct. Internal motions, okay. Internal motions would probably not have a very big effect. Even you could broaden the lines a little bit, but because the lines are getting very, very optically thick so quickly, even if you have some broadening due to turbulence, for example, this is not going to be a very, very big effect.
The turbulence is supersonic, right? So the oil line is
if you go to that extreme limit, then this would change this. Let me continue. I don't want to hang up on that. Okay, so this is H2 formation. So H2 formation is parameterized by a simple number. So this is the simplest version of the rate coefficient. Of course, there are a lot of physics that goes into this, and that's actually a black box. But that's another talk. But one can take this number, and again, Z prime is the metallicity. This also sets the time scale for equilibrium, which we're also assuming here, but the equilibrium time scale can start getting quite long when the metallicity is low. So this is the typical number. Eventually, the other thing is I want to just note, eventually when it goes to sufficiently low metallicity, the gas phase processes start to control the H2 formation, and we're not assuming those here. So here are the basic theory questions. With this kind of setup, what do the depth-dependent H1 to H2 transition profiles look like? And what is the resulting total H1 column density or H1 mass surface density for a UV-illuminated cloud? Okay, so there's, you know, getting back to Wittgenstein, so we need to find, so he's saying, okay, find the dimensionless parameter. That will enable us to get to the intermediate case, which is the analytic theory. And So the dimensionless parameter is called alpha G. Alpha is not the fine structure constant, and G is not the Newton's constant. And I also want to emphasize that G is also not the, it's not G0, it's not the UV intensity. It's something else, so just to clarify that. So alpha is actually the ratio of the free space dissociation rate to the H2 formation rate, and G is kind of a mean self-shielding factor. It can also be written this way, and in the 2014 paper, this is all explained. So I first, this dimensionless parameter, as I defined first in this 1988 paper, Chris and Mark rediscovered it partly in their series of papers, and it's all clarified. All these connections are clarified in our 2014 paper. It's actually a little bit, it has various physical meanings. One way of looking at it is by calling it the H1 dust absorption rate of the effective dissociation flux. So what do I mean by H1 dust? Eventually, one's going to have some part of the gas is going to be atomic, and part of the gas is going to be molecular. And one can look at the dust just associated with the H1, ask what is the rate at which the dust associated just with the H1 is absorbing the effective dissociation flux. And the ratio of that quantity in the numerator to the free space H2 photodissociation rate. That's one way of describing it. And putting in physical parameters, where sigma G is the cross-section, this is the flux, this is the rate coefficient, that's the density, and this is little W, you can see that in general, for interstellar conditions, alpha G can be small, and I call that the weak field, or large, and that's called the strong field. Yeah, phi G is a fudge factor relating the dust cross-section, the actual dust cross-section to the metallicity, and that depends on the dust properties itself. That's a factor of order unity, so just forget about it. Okay, it's a fudge factor. Okay, so alpha G basically describes this three-way competition for the FUV absorption. When alpha G is large, that's the strong field limit. The dissociation is so effective, you get the column of H1 starts to get so large that the dust associated with that H1 column is the main source of absorption for the radiation. That's the strong field. Weak field limit is divided into two cases. There's alpha G, both alpha G less than one, but then there's low metallicity and high metallicity. In the low metallicity case, all of the available radiation goes into H2 lines. At high metallicity, there's a competition between H2 lines and the dust associated with the H2. So alpha G, this dimensionless parameter, encapsulates all of these limits. Okay, so in S14 and then also in this follow-up paper, so there's the APJ reference. So here's a calculation of profiles, H1 to H2 profiles, in a two-dimensional parameter space going from small alpha G to large alpha G. So here alpha G is small, here alpha G is large. From high metallicity to low metallicity. Each panel here, there are three curves. So this is, for example, the H1 density normalized to unity. This is the H2 density, so here it's all H1. Here it's H2 is very small, then it grows, finally becomes fully molecular. So here you have, this is the transition point, that red dot. Everything is normalized to one. The dash curve shows the integral, normalized integral of the H1 density. So the H1, this is basically the H1 column normalized. And in all these calculations, I'm assuming that the medium is optically thick, so that all the radiation is absorbed. So the H1 column actually finally does reach a limit, and it's normalized to one here. Now, the interesting thing, what I plotted, the x-axis is, this is actually interesting and important. The x-axis is actually the dust opacity. So for any given column, I can calculate the dust opacity, assuming the metallicity, which determines the dust cross-section. And the surprising thing, okay, so let's just look at this a little bit. You can see that the shapes of the curves depend on whether you're in the weak field limit or the strong field limit. So for example, look at the case of metallicity of one. In the strong field limit, you can see it's all atomic, and then you get to this transition point, and there's a sharp transition. It's sharp in the sense that the integrated H1 column is all built up on the outside. So here it's all H1, and the H1 column is all built up on the outside. In the weak field limit, the absorption is controlled by H2 line absorption, which is not an exponential. It's not an exponential behavior. It's much weaker than that because of the way the lines are absorbing. And you can see that the transitions are now not sharp. So here's the transition point. But you can see that even though you're totally molecular here, there's still quite a bit of H1 inside. And because the scale length is very long, most of the H1 column is actually built up inside the molecular zone. So you have these two limits. In the strong field limit, the transitions are sharp. Everything is built up on, the H1 is all built up on the outside. In the weak field limit, the transitions are not sharp, and all of the H1 is built up inside. Finally, there's a cutoff because the dust cuts you off always. Okay, so. Now the interesting thing about these curves, if you look at them, you can see that really the shapes of the curves depend to a good approximation only on the metallicity and alpha G, when plotted as a function of tau dust, even in the case when the transition is controlled by self-shielding and has nothing to do with dust absorption. You can see, for example, here, the transition is occurring at a dust opacity of 10 to the minus 4, which is negligible dust opacity. Okay. So this was already pointed out in S14. We expanded on that in this paper. Okay, I should also say that this is relevant for simulations. In this paper, we also give an analytic formula for where this point occurs in general as a function of metallicity and alpha G. But that, I'm not going to talk about that here. Okay, so weak field, most of the H1 is built up inside the H2 zone, gradual profiles. strong field, most of the H1 is built up in the outer layer sharp profiles. The FUV is dominated by H1 dust in this case. In this case, it's dominated by H2 lines plus H2 dust. And this is this basic result. Okay, so then you can ask, what is the total column density of H1 that's built up in such a system? And this is our general formula for that. It's derived in two, we derived it in two ways in S14. And the beauty of it is that it's valid for all regimes. Weak and strong fields, gradual sharp transition, arbitrary metallicity. Okay? So you can see, if you just look at alpha G is the dimensionless parameter, and these are the actual parameters instead of alpha G. So this is what this function looks like as N1. This is the H1 column as a function of alpha G. In the weak field limit, the H1 column that's built up simply grows linearly with the radiation field strength. I remind you, alpha G is the ratio of flux to density. So if I keep everything fixed, and I just imagine I'm increasing the flux, so naturally, if I increase the flux, I get more H1, more atomic column. But eventually it saturates, and the reason it's saturating and it starts to grow logarithmically is because the H1 itself starts to absorb self-limits, because the H1, the dust associated with the H1 starts to absorb the radiation. Okay, so I'm going to try to make sense out of this. I'm going to try to make sense out of this equation. So in the weak field limit, alpha G is low. I can write this, I can expand the log, and this is the expression that you get, or which can actually be written this way. Left-hand side is formation rate per unit area. The right-hand side is effective dissociation flux. That's just a Skronberg relation. Everything, I'm absorbing all the radiation. The rate at which I absorb the radiation equals to the rate at which I'm forming molecules per unit area. In the strong field limit, okay, I can then, the strong field limit, I can neglect the log term, and then the total column is just 1 over the dust cross-section. And that also makes sense, because when H1 dust dominates the attenuation of the far UV field, the H1 column is self-limited. Okay, so the optical depth associated, you expect the transition to occur at an optical depth of 1, and that's what happens. Okay, let me skip over the metallicity dependence. And so here is the general purpose formula. And as I said, it's useful for interpreting observations, for hydrodynamic simulations, and applications to self-regulated media. So let me do that. So I don't have to explain this again, because Mark Wolf already explained this nicely. Here's the pressure versus density curve for thermal equilibrium. And very often one finds that clouds are in the disk, at least, are at pressures at which multiphase conditions occur. This fact led to this very nice idea in the paper of Krumholtz, McKee, and Thomas in 2009, who argued that, well, in principle, alpha G, or what they called chi, in principle, alpha G, or the radiation field limit density, can be arbitrarily set. But if you assume multiphase conditions for the shielding layers of the molecular clouds, then you're forced to a density which is in this narrow, cold cloud density which is in this narrow range. But that cold cloud density is itself a function of the heating rate of the radiation field. Okay. So if you adopt this ansatz, which I think is actually too strong, but if you adopt it, then you are now forced to a universal value of alpha G divided by 2 of about 1. And so that means, that so if you assume this, that means for any given metallicity, one can then read off what the H1 column has to be. So doing that, and this is following the idea in KMT09, doing that and plugging into my formula, you get a characteristic H1 photo dissociation mass, which is essentially just 1 over the dust cross section converted to solar masses square unit area equal to this. And one can then multiply that by 2 to say that's the transition at which, that's the total gas mass of a cloud, assuming half of it is an H1. Okay, now that's a nice idea, but I think it's too strong. And I want to show that in the following analysis. So I was thinking about this problem. I was actually in the Vatican Museum, And I was walking down the hallway there. I don't know if you've ever been. That's a fantastic place. And suddenly, I see this globe staring me in the face. I was thinking about Perseus. So there it was. And this is a more modern version of Perseus. So there's the... I did not look at the Medusa, I know. Okay, so there's the cloud. And the nice thing about this is it's a star-forming cloud, but only low-mass stars. And it has within it various sub-regions. And in a recent paper by Lietal, they actually looked at the H1 to H2 transitions along several lines of sight in there. So what this is from the Lietal paper. This is H2 over H1 as a function of total column. And if one then applies, one can actually fit these data using the S14 formula. And I'll just show you what the fits look like. So those are the fits. Those are pretty nice. Okay, but that's nice, but that's not the main point I want to make here. Main point is that I want to make is as follows. One can take our basic formula, here it is, and in this parameter space of sigma versus alpha g, plot the observed H1 columns that Lietal saw in these various subregions. Okay, so these are the observations in this. These are the observations. This assuming sitting the left-hand side equal to the observed H1 columns, this is what this function looks like in this parameter space. Okay. Now, there's reason to set the dust cross-section to somewhere between these two lines. This would be typical, and there's some evidence for a slightly higher dust content in this cloud. So this is the observed range for sigma g. If one assumes CNM conditions, one would be confined to, like I was saying, alpha g over 2 of about 1 is confined to this region. However, you can see that the observations are forcing us to much higher values of alpha g. So one can actually then derive the following parameters. Here's the cloud. It's embedded in an external radiation field because there are no massive stars in there. So this is the radiation field it's embedded in. Even without knowing what the radiation field is, just by looking where these curves pass through these two dashed lines, you can read off that the dimensionless parameter, alpha g, is around 5 to 50 in all of these lines of sight. This immediately says that the FUV absorption is dominated by H1 dust, according to the theory. One can take the radiation field strength and then convert that to a density. The density is quite low. So the conclusion that we have from this is actually the shielding layers here are not pure CNM. It's probably a combination of thermally unstable gas with the CNM mixed in with it. Now, I want to emphasize that this is a conclusion based entirely on analysis of the H1 columns and the analytic theory. I know, I have to stop. One can then go out and actually try to measure, determine the fractions of thermally unstable versus purely cold gas in the shielding layers, and this conclusion is actually consistent with these recent results. So that's a very nice consistency. This is a purely theoretical conclusion, but that's observed. Okay, I want to show one last slide, and I'll conclude. I want to come back to this plot. Well, again, assuming alpha G CNM, adopting the Krumholtz, McKee, Tomlinson ansatz, predicts sigma gas star-forming threshold, a sigma gas for which star formation will set in due to the H1 to H2 conversion of around 12 solar masses per square parsec. And that's very close to this 10. So that's, in principle, kind of exciting, potentially explanation. But I think this is not the explanation, mainly because this would require, so I think it's a coincidence, mainly because concluding this basically would require typically one primary cloud per line of sight, or even average over the beams, and that seems highly implausible. So this threshold here requires more study. Okay, so that's my conclusion. I want to emphasize this nice formula that's described in this very detailed paper and those two other papers, which I referred to at the start, and I'll stop there.
Nice questions, comments?
And overwhelmed audience.
Overwhelmed.
So going back to the last point that you were making, which I think is a point about scales. You were fundamentally saying that, I mean, this analysis would apply to small scales.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to be very careful when you're trying to look at kiloparsec observations.
That's another way of saying that. Mm-hmm.
So what is setting the column density in the...
Well, I mean, I would say that if you look at it in a large beam, okay, so one's going to, in general, have many clouds. If one adopts this ansatz, which I think just the analysis on small scale shows is probably too strong, but even if one adopts it, okay, then each cloud surface is going to get this, each subregion is going to have 10 solar masses per square parsec, but then one has to then average, then there's, one has to apply an area filling factor to that, multiply by the number of clouds, that's going to make this number very large, but then it's going to come back down again after one puts in the area average filling factor. And to me, it would seem miraculous that this gives you back the original 10 that you started with. So I think the 10 is coming from something else. That's my conclusion.
But as a comment, there is this data of Alberto for SMC, which is at low metallicity and at high resolution, mm-hmm. right, where transition is happening at larger column density. So that there, it would be your small would be applicable,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. But he was getting the 1 hour C type dependence too. No, you were invoking the N1 column has an inverse metallicity dependence.
Too. Yes, right, it does.
So
that's a trivial thing. All it is in the strong field limit. Basically, the way to think about it, there's 10 solar masses in the strong field limit. That's simply 1/1 the dust cross section. So if you assume, you know, whatever the dust cross section is for any metallicity, it'll get bigger. You know, the dust cross decreases, so 1/1 that gives you a larger H1 column.
Oh, I just wanted to follow up that for one quick thing. What is the filling factor of molecular gas in a beam, and how many clouds are in a beam? Because we talk about that, but then no one ever actually puts down the numbers, because we kind of need a context.
I wish someone would tell me that, yeah.
Oh, we don't know?
I don't know. Oh. I don't know that.
I don't know. That's why I asked you.
The observers should know this. Yeah, it depends on the galaxy. Right, I don't think there's a unit. I don't think there's, I don't need that.
You don't need that.
Yeah, so it depends on the galaxy. It depends on how far away they are. How big the beam. Yeah.
You go to something like EULAR, the molecular gas filling factor is 1.
Yeah.
See, the range is 0 to 1.
Okay. Make comments in the microphone.
Okay, Emil, I wanted to ask you about your very nice results in the Perseus cloud. Mm. So when you analyze the cold neutral medium or the atomic gas around the cloud, are you sensitive to things like anisotropy in the radiation field? I mean, that's my first question. And the second one, now that you have a better understanding of the atomic gas around the cloud, can you say anything about the potential implications for GMC lifetimes or formation models? There are many ideas out there of whether GMCs are very transient features forming rapidly from H1, but you obviously need, you know, that would make a very different prediction from more static models.
I'm talking about in principle, the H2 formation time in these outer layers, that's actually quite long because densities are low. On the other hand, I don't know anything about what the densities are on the inner side, inner parts. Those could be much higher, in which case I can't really say anything about the time scales for cloud formation. On the other hand, as far as the first question, we are assuming an isotropic. The thing that's nice about this system, except for one of those sources, which may have a B star or a late type B star in it, all of the far UV is coming from the outside. So we just assume it's isotropic. Okay. In fact, this equation. That's why this factor of 1/4 has to do with the assumption about the geometry for the radiation field. Radiation field in this theory is assumed to be isotropic.
No, I know it is in the theory, but...
Yeah. So I'm assuming I did not worry about anisotropy in interpreting the observations. I will say that in one of those clouds, there might be a star which may be producing some radiation, and that's the one that also happens to have the highest H1 column associated with it. So...
The question was, should you worry about it?
I don't know.
Can you see any evidence for it? Is there any reason
about
to
this
think?
Honestly, I've not thought about it. So,
with respect to your result of a lower number density compared to CNM, but in the regime where you have this two-phase medium, right, mm-hmm. it's easy to be either in one or the other, right? Mm-hmm.
Well,
So is this just what you're seeing, essentially, that there is gas sort of, because in a simple geometry, there's always clean transition from one to the other. But if you make things a little bit more complicated, for example, radiation field varying, density varying, right, you immediately get gas getting either there or there because it's very easy to get.
Yeah, okay, so that's a good question.
Right?
And we
thought. So is this what you're seeing?
Well, I would say, yeah. So in the theory, we're assuming uniform density. So it's an effective density. You could say it's some kind of average density. And so this 2 to 50 is assuming uniform density, what is, you know, assuming uniform density, what is that uniform density? Of course, in reality, there are going to be fluctuations. Okay, and so that actually we're working on, this is actually a project that we're actually working on at the moment, assuming that these fluctuations are driven by turbulence, how would that affect these overall H1 columns? The effect is not going to be very large. So again, my picture is, in other words, I think that this effective density is a valuable parameter, even though in reality, around in the shielding layers, there are fluctuations in the density. All I'm saying is that we're forced to a limit in which some of these density fluctuations include densities which are in the thermally unstable phase. That's what I'm saying.
Any further questions or comments? If not, let's thank Amil again. And we're moving on to the last talk of the morning session by Ivan Skillman, who will tell us about star formation in low metallicity galaxies.